Thank you. That's very, very kind of you. I want to invite my friend and colleague Ben Young to come up. I want to also thank Ben for ceding some of his time, although we're going to let him go a little bit past 10 as well. I'm not going to give a whole bio on you, but I got to spend some really cool time with Ben in Kenya this January, riding around the Land Rover in rural Kenya and bouncing along the roads, and learned a lot about his work, about his personal life, and I'm thrilled that he's the next presenter.
Wow. Thanks, Muggs and Merve, for giving me the opportunity to follow Bob. I'm the, if you don't know me, many of you don't, I'm the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of IAPAC. First, I want to personally extend a very hearty welcome and thank you to all of you for coming to Fort Lauderdale. And more importantly, for the work that you all have continue to do and have done for so many years in the past. It's always personally a very somewhat challenging and daunting, if not humbling, experience to try to impart some shred of context and insight into this world where so many of the people in this audience have actually contributed to them, to that knowledge. And in fact, I'll tell you my disclosure right from the beginning. None of the data, none of the slides I'm going to show you is anything that I work on. So that means I actually take neither any responsibility for that, but actually what you get is really my somewhat edited view of a more structural, small molecule view of ending the ending epidemic AIDS. And so what I'm going to try to do in a concise way, at high speed, at a high altitude way, is to take what is a relatively orthodox view of medications and do some translational thinking and hopefully therefore some thought-provoking around what does all this mean for ending the epidemic in the context of ending or improving adherence. And it is so elegantly framed by the ambassador yesterday. What does this mean in terms of service delivery? What does this mean in terms of, and Ed's Gardner somewhere in the audience, improving care continuums? And so the goal here is to talk about new directions in antiretroviral therapies, but from the context of what do those new therapies offer us in terms of, or what they might offer us in terms of adherence, service delivery, and care continuum. Okay. These are my disclosures. The clinic that I so privileged to work in as a clinician in Denver, Colorado, actually receives research support from a number of institutions, and I serve on advisory boards and the last remaining speaker bureau in my portfolio. It's a changing world. Okay, so these are truths that we know. We debate this sometimes in august panels and in policy discussions, but we know that HIV treatment works. We know that treating HIV preserves or restores immune function. We know this. In fact, we'd known this even before the science actually told us this, because people working in the field, people living with HIV, and again, we have this wonderful spectrum of participants at this conference, know this, because we've seen this in our friends, in our communities, in our families, and in the people we serve. We also know that it prevents progression to AIDS. We know that treatment prevents serious illness and death. We have seen the retrogression in the fortunate parts of the world, and they're not just now defined by the relationship to the equator, but in places of the world where we give, we care enough to deliver services, we prevent illness and death. These are life-saving interventions. We also know, and through the elegant work of many of the people here, in fact, I'm going to show some of your data, that HIV treatment prevents transmission. We know this. Yeah. The time for debating these general tenets, is over. The issue, however, is that these things only work in people who are tested, in individuals who are able to adhere to care and treatment. So I'm going to expand the conventional view of adherence, not just to pill taking, but to the notion of getting tested, getting into a thoughtful, non-judgmental, non-criminalizing care environment with capable, knowledgeable care providers, and getting on good medicines, and then being able to do what the Orthodox view is actually taking those medicines in a way that's appropriate and as instructed. Instructed by thoughtful, knowledgeable, caring providers. So I'm going to frame this discussion really not just in the new drug equals something about adherence, but actually in the larger view of the spectrum of things that I think are important around adhering to therapies, to care. Okay? So I'm going to talk about treatment initiation guidelines and treatment guidelines and what's changed and the new directions there. I'm going to talk about some changing views about newly approved antiretroviral therapies, the ones that we already have in our hands. And in a sense, a question is, do we need new drugs to treat HIV, or do we have an adequate portfolio of those products already? I think the answer is we've got a pretty good, actually we have an awfully good armamentarium, but in fact there's still room for improvement. And I try to very quickly summarize a portfolio of really exciting, that's my, you know, you can already get the conclusion, exciting data that's emerging on either investigational products or investigational approaches. And so for those of you who are getting CME, this is the part that may include off-label or investigational medications. Okay. All right, so here we go. So new directions in antiretroviral guidelines. I was very proud last summer to serve on the panel at the World Health Organization in Geneva that resulted in, I think, at the global level, I mean, I'm trying to speak not just, I know there's a lot of mostly American or U.S. Providers and researchers in this audience, but I'm going to try to provide at least for a moment a global view of all this. And so while in the United States, we have had a recommendation for antiretroviral initiation irrespective of CD4 count or clinical stage since 2012, we're now 4 years past that point. In fact, it was only last October that the World Health Organization announced this, or released this guideline, which recommended, and I'll quote, antiretroviral therapy should be initiated in all adults living with HIV at any CD4 cell count. And that was a strong recommendation, which means just do it, because HIV treatment works. Okay? It also made the strong recommendation that pregnant women should be started on treatment, duh. And that treatment should be continued for life. Duh, duh. Yeah. We also got to give a thumbs up vote for PrEP. Okay? And I'll read that oral PrEP should be offered to as an additional prevention choice for people at substantial risk as part of combination prevention. Strong recommendation. So the science is very clear, and at last, finally, the WHO makes this recommendation for all people living with HIV in all nations. Hard stop. Seems trivial at this point at some level, because it's like this is a foregone conclusion, but it took a lot of time and a colossal effort of community and research and investment to get us to this point. Okay? The issue, as Ruben in part alluded to yesterday, is that it takes time to get these words implemented. And so this is a screenshot from Ruben's really elegant, if you haven't looked at it. HIV Policy Watch is a compendium sort of geotag where you can hover over any nation and get the most recent published treatment guidelines in any of those nations. The blue nations on these represent the 14 nations that do have universal recommendations for universal treatment, and those that are in red have a long way to go. And our goal, my goal, is to make this, to paint the world blue. Everybody has national recommendations for universal treatment. There's a long way to go, and the question is, can we accelerate that? And as Ambassador Burke spoke about yesterday, I'm really proud very pleased to hear, I'm also proud to hear this, that PEPFAR is moving quickly to implement universal treatment in PEPFAR nations, many of which right now on this map are green. And to just say one last word about PEPFAR, I think it was also illuminating and important that as we think about treatment guidelines, we have known in an emerging body of evidence-based medicine suggests that we don't need to force people and providers to see patients who are otherwise doing well every month. That takes an incredible amount of resources and time out of people's lives to force a doctor patient or clinic patient, medical patient engagement on a monthly basis. So increasing the interval of time for interventions and evaluations of people not only is good for people, it's actually good for healthcare systems and shouldn't prove throughput, and at very little, if any, cost. Okay. Now, this is where I get to interject these other ideas about, so do these things actually improve adherence? Do these interventions improve engagement in the care system? Do these interventions improve overall outcomes? Not just viral suppression, quality of life, and so on. All right, so let's move more to what if you saw the title and you're excited to hear about new drugs, let's talk about drugs rather than the structural and guideline interventions. So let's talk a little bit about new directions in antiretroviral therapies. And so I'm going to summarize the specific drug recommendations both within the U.S. guidelines as a metaphor for high-income countries. And again, for those of you not from the United States, I don't really apologize for this as much as I'm not going to go through every nation's treatment guidelines, in part because they are reflective of some of the words I'll say. Okay. So these are the recommended by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the recommended regimens for initial therapy. And they represent five regimens that include an HIV integrase strand transfer inhibitor, an integrase inhibitor, and one protease inhibitor-based regimen. What's remarkable about the guidelines, and I don't know if David is in the room, David Wall, but there are guidelines, I know there's at least one guideline panel member here, and a Herculean amount of effort went to changing these guidelines last year, which resulted in the fact that you don't see the word efavirenz on this list anymore. You don't see the word non-nucleoside on this list anymore. And so it's just huge change. For the first time in the history of the HIV treatment guidelines, which goes back many decades now, there's no recommendation for non-nucleoside therapy because the science actually supports some of that. What's in yellow is also the latest addition to this list, which is the fixed-dose combination of elvitegravir, cobicistat, tenofovir, allophenamide, and FTC. I'll do my best to avoid using trade names. So again, the guidelines continue to evolve. It's a living document and so on. And so TAF represents an onward evolution of tenofovir. The World Health Organization guidelines also similarly evolved, truncated on my picture but not on yours, to include two things that I think were also interesting. And we'll talk a little bit more about from an evidence perspective. One was the inclusion of dolutegravir, which is the first of the HIV integrase inhibitors to appear on international guidelines. And certainly the WHO guidelines, and then efavirenz, 400 milligrams of efavirenz, so a lower dose of efavirenz. So the hegemony of efavirenz and nevirapine on the WHO guidelines actually has a crack in it, it's opening. And so these guidelines are also in evolution. The question is, what does this mean? What is the science behind this, and what does this mean for adherence and care continuum? So one of the reasons why, in part, that we've seen the success and the pivot in the guidelines around integrase inhibitors, and in this case specifically around dolutegravir, and I'll try to keep this again, this review is going to be high speed, high altitude, and pertain to more recent publications and presentations in the last 6 months or so. So this is interesting data that was published in JAC that looks at the terminal half-life after giving someone a dose of dolutegravir. Okay? The dashed line represents the therapeutic level, the level necessary to inhibit the virus. And the basic conclusion is after someone takes a dose of dolutegravir, 60 hours after administration of that, 60 hours, the large majority, 16 out of 17 individuals in this detailed pharmacokinetic study, actually had therapeutic levels. Right? So I think this should really force us to recalibrate the way we think about adherence, or more importantly, non-adherence. So maybe adherence is one thing that's important, clearly important, but adherence and viral suppression may be uncoupled here a little bit. Or maybe this poses the opportunity to think about therapies that are not administered daily, and we'll talk a lot about that in the minutes to come. Okay? But this is just a glimpse of that, and it may be why, in many places, the cascade of treatment failure and treatment emergent drug resistance actually may be slowing down. In fact, in many clinics, I think it already has. I don't have data slides on this because I wanted to summarize a whole lot of information on this in four bullet points. But for years, we've used tenofovir fumarate, a TDF, 300 milligrams a day, and the new formulation is a prodrug, which has better bioavailability, and that means you go from 300 milligrams down to 25 milligrams. Okay. So what does that mean? Well, it means it's a smaller pill, literally. It also means, for reasons I won't get into, lower risk of renal and bone toxicity. But it also means because there's a ceiling, a numerical ceiling for how many milligrams of drug you can pack into a pill. It means that drug regimens, such as TDF-FTC, that's Truvada plus darunavir and a boosting agent, went from being a 2 or 3 pill regimen to a 1 pill regimen. And I think there are opportunities for us to think and to evaluate whether going from a 3 pill or 2 pill to a 1 pill regimen actually offers improvements, not just in adherence, not just in viral suppression, but also in things like quality of life and impact on the psychosocial burden of HIV. This is a glimpse of a large set of data from the ENCORE study. This is the study that compared in a randomized placebo-controlled trial 600 milligram efavirenz to 400 milligram efavirenz. And the short take on this, and this is the histogram looking at the drug-related adverse events in the study, and what you see is that, perhaps not surprisingly, there's less adverse events when you give less drug. But the important part of this in a well-powered, international, placebo-controlled, randomized study that's been published in high-quality journals was that there was no apparent difference in the virologic or immunologic effect of the regimen. So you can have your cake and have less bloating. Okay? And this, of course, was reflected in the WHO guidelines, which, again, was an off-label use of the drug in the United States. All right. Future directions in antiretroviral therapies. A few years ago, I think I was quoted publicly in saying, I don't think we need no new stinking HIV drugs because we've got the drugs we need. We just have need to get them to people because we can save millions of lives today with the tools that we have. And I was a bit of a naysayer when it came to we must have new things because that, gives drug companies new patents and more profit extension and so on. But in fact, I think there's some really exciting areas that, again, are in the pipeline and rattle that perhaps immature view of where we're going. Right. So I think there are very exciting things in the future, and the question, again, is will they pan out? And what does that mean for adherence, viral suppression, quality of life, and care systems? So this is one area where I think stay tuned, because I think this is really nearer term and also very exciting. So these are the data from the pilot study conducted in Buenos Aires called PADDLE. It was presented a number of times, most recently by Figueroa at the EECS conference and led by my good friend and IAPAC friend, Pedro Kahn. And so this is the notion. So we used to say, monotherapy was bad, dual therapy was bad, triple therapy saves lives. Don't ever, ever use anything but that. Well, in fact, with newer drugs, maybe that may not be true. And so Pedro, years ago, did a study that looked at using lamivudine with a boosted protease inhibitor and in a study called Gardel, and it turns out, if you use potent drugs, actually two drugs seem to be as good as three. Now, there was a lot of baggage with that study. It never really took off. But now using in the 2015, 2016, let's say, future cast, actually, he did this very interesting and provocative pilot study called PADDLE, which used dolutegravir, the integrase inhibitor, and lamivudine, the old industry standard and available generically as a two-drug initial therapy for patients. And this is an off-label use of drug, just to be clear. And these are the data on the viral suppression in these 20 individuals. Yellow actually shows you where the people have undetectable viral loads, and green shows you those people who have viral loads below 1,000 and so on. But the point is, after 8 weeks, all 20 of these individuals had undetectable virus. So two-drug therapy might work. And that has a number of side effect and adverse effect implications. It has implications in terms of cost. That has been published by Rochelle Walensky in CID just a few weeks ago, and so on. So the notion of using simpler therapies may reduce drug number, pill volume, cost, and side effect profiles. And the phase 3 studies for these are being planned. So this is not just one pilot study done in some country south of the equator. In fact, this is coming to a neighborhood near you soon. Again, we've mentioned how much efavirenz has played a role in all of these therapies, and so doravirine is a new investigational non-nucleoside, which in a phase 2 one-year study actually showed similar virologic and immunologic effects compared to efavirenz, but has statistically significantly lower rates of side effects. So in similar to the 400 milligram efavirenz data, perhaps a better non-nucleoside. Okay, so those phase three studies are underway. And these, again, these were data presented by Jose Gatell at CROI just a few weeks ago. This study and this strategy has generated a ton of interest. And this is the notion of giving very long-acting injectable combination therapies. In this particular case, this is the one that's the furthest in development, is the combination of rilpivirine with an investigational integrase inhibitor, cabotegravir. And these were the data from the LOTTE-2 study presented by David Margolis, a Colorado graduate, Ray Ed, at CROI. And so this interesting strategy gives people oral medications to make sure that they tolerate them, and then they get randomized either to continue on oral pills or get a once a month or once every other month injectable regimen. Okay. And the virologic success, less than 50 copies, was 95%, whether one got a shot in the tush every month or every other month. So this has, again, assuming that this data moves forward, then again, there are manifold implications in terms of those of you who think about the social and behavioral consequences of therapy, because going from a daily pill to a shot every 1 or 2 months must have implications in terms of the way we think about the way we engage therapy, the way we engage care. If once a month sounds good or once every other month sounds good, well, stay tuned. The folks at Merck have presented data at CROI on EFDA, a investigational nucleoside RT inhibitor with incredibly long half-life. So it could be. It appears, at least based on some early stage data, that this might be administered once a week as a pill. So forget about getting a shot in the tush, just take a pill once a week. But if you like the shot, how about taking some? This drug appears to have pharmacokinetics that supports every 6 month dosing, maybe longer. Come in once every 6 months to see your doc, get a shot, you're good. Oh, and how about PrEP for that? Just throwing that out there. Speaking of PrEP. So, as I said, we know PrEP works, but we know that you have to take the daily medication we use for PrEP for it to work. But we also know through this really amazing, elegant study published by Bob Grant, but also with authors in the audience, including Reve, using some really sophisticated pharmacokinetics that were also done at the University of Colorado. Just got to get my plug in for my home institution, my alma mater. And a shout out to all of my friends from Colorado who are in the audience. We can use sophisticated ways to actually measure and estimate the number of pills needed to be taken for therapeutic success. And again, the number in this particular analysis wasn't 7 pills per week every week. It was actually somewhere maybe 4 to 6 was good enough. Perfection not required for HIV treatment to work. Okay. But you know, taking a daily pill for prevention is and can be considered a nuisance, a nag. It has lots of other implications in terms of adherence, engagement in care, et cetera. Can we improve on that? And certainly one of the areas that needs improvement is the ability to empower women in novel ways for prevention. And again, we saw the data presented by Jared Baton at CROI and published in New England Journal on the use of the dapivirine, a non-nucleoside, in an impregnated, no pun intended, vaginal ring. And this confers a modest but statistically significant degree of protection for women against HIV infection. We also saw at CROI from data presented by Tripp Gulick in the HPTN group on the use of maraviroc as a preventive therapy for HIV. So it's not just all TDF and FTC for prevention. Lots of interesting and provocative new ways to think about preventing HIV. One of the things, and I think this is my last data slide, that I think is also very thought-provoking, is the idea of using very long-acting injectable medications for PrEP. And so these were data presented by Marty Markowitz from the Eclair group, looking at that investigational HIV integrase inhibitor, cabotegravir. And this was a study that was both pharmacokinetic, but then also at an acceptability pilot study, giving the calculated dose to HIV negative men mostly, and the soft fuzzy conclusion was that this seemed to be, despite the volume of the injection, in a very acceptable mode of administration and an acceptable side effect profile. What you see on this on the data slide is the pharmacokinetic side of this, which, although the team was hoping that this could be administered every 3 months, it looks like it'll have to be administered every 2 months. But instead of a daily pill now, imagine an intervention that requires a visit to the doc every 8 weeks, a shot in the tush every 8 weeks for PrEP. Now, I should say, and although I didn't earlier, that in rhesus monkey studies, it had very, very high effectiveness in preventing monkeys from either vaginal or intrarectal challenge, repeated intrarectal challenge with simian HIV. Okay. So what does this mean for us in the way we think about care delivery, service delivery, in terms of adherence, in terms of cost, in terms of patient adherence? Because now we're no longer just asking people to take a pill when they go home. We're actually asking them to come back into the clinic to get an intervention. Right? So there's a number of, I think, challenging social behavioral service delivery aspects to something which is sort of abstract as a PK curve. Okay. But HIV therapies do work. And universal access to ART shouldn't just improve lives of the people that take medicines. I think that actually improves the entire notion of care delivery. If we offer people therapy when they come into care, the notion of people in this pre-contemplative mode, in this pre-ART care mode, actually collapses, and everybody gets access, at least is offered therapy at the time that they're diagnosed or around that time. And again, as Bob so importantly said, when they're ready to be on treatment. Improvements in currently approved antiretroviral therapies, both in terms of treatment guidelines, but also in terms of the way we administer them and the way we think about monitoring them, have continued to evolve. Right? So I'm sure that we will see 400 milligram efavirenz in sub-Saharan Africa in the near future. And I'm sure, I think, that we'll have the birth of integrase inhibitors on the African continent in the near future. And the role of integrase inhibitors in the United States and Western Europe have really changed the way that patients engage in care, the way that doctors engage, this doctor engages with his patients, is that my patients do great on therapy and really go off and live life and come back and see me in 6 months. End of story. Okay. That's why I'm here, not tending to my patients who might otherwise be ill. Okay. And so newer drugs are here, and they have changed U.S. treatment guidelines, they are changing European guidelines, they are changing guidelines in Latin America, not yet in Eastern Europe and Central Asia, but we're working on that too. Finally, investigational medicines and investigational strategies, I think, are actually quite exciting, both from the pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic perspective, but also from the implications that these systems and these studies, investigational medications, offer us for the way we think and evaluate adherence. So the challenge for my colleagues who are more social and behavioral scientists is, so what does it mean from an adherence perspective? What does it mean from a psychological burden perspective to go from taking a daily pill to, let's just arbitrarily say, a once-weekly pill, or once-monthly or every other monthly injection? What does that mean for costing? What does that mean for throughput? What does two-drug therapy with well-tolerated and potent drugs mean? What does having long-acting injectable drugs mean? What does having a vaginal ring for women at risk of HIV mean, not just for preventing HIV, but for the way we engage systems? Okay. And so the last point is that while the conventional orthodox phase 3 and phase 4 clinical trials programs will continue to evolve on these products, I think we should be thinking very opportunistically about using these as model systems to understand the way we think about adherence and the way we think about care systems and care continuums. Because in the end, if we get all this right, we will end epidemic AIDS in the near-term future. Thank you.